4. At the same time that Cohen finalized his written submission to Congress, he served as a source for a Washington Post story published on August 27, 2017, that reported in depth for the first time that the Trump Organization was pursuing a plan to develop a massive Trump Tower in Moscow, at the same time as candidate Trump was running for president in late 2015 and early 2016. Footnote 995. The article reported that the project was abandoned at the end of January 2016, just before the presidential primaries began, several people familiar with the proposal said. Footnote 996. Cohen recalled that in speaking to the Post, he held to the false story that negotiations for the deal ceased in January 2016. Footnote 997. On August 28, 2017, Cohen submitted his statement about the Trump Tower Moscow project to Congress. Footnote 998. Cohen did not recall talking to the president about the specifics of what the statement said, or what Cohen would later testify to about Trump Tower Moscow. Footnote 999. He recalled speaking to the president more generally about how he planned to stay on message in his testimony. Footnote 1000. On September 19, 2017, in anticipation of his impending testimony, Cohen orchestrated the public release of his opening remarks to Congress, which criticized the allegations in the Steele material and claimed that the Trump Tower Moscow project was terminated in January of 2016, which occurred before the Iowa caucus and months before the very first primary. Footnote 1001. Cohen said the release of his opening remarks was intended to shape the narrative and let other people who might be witnesses know what Cohen was saying so they could follow the same message. Footnote 1002. Cohen said his decision was meant to mirror Jared Kushner's decision to release a statement in advance of Kushner's congressional testimony, which the president's personal counsel had told Cohen the president liked. Footnote 1003. Cohen recalled that on September 20, 2017, after Cohen's opening remarks had been printed by the media, the president's personal counsel told him that the president was pleased with the Trump Tower Moscow statement that had gone out. Footnote 1004. On October 24 and 25, 2017, Cohen testified before Congress and repeated the false statements he had included in his written statement about Trump Tower Moscow. Footnote 1005. Phone records show that Cohen spoke with the president's personal counsel immediately after his testimony on both days. Footnote 1006. 4. The president sends messages of support to Cohen. In January 2018, the media reported that Cohen had arranged a $130,000 payment during the campaign to prevent a woman from publicly discussing an alleged sexual encounter she had with the president before he ran for office. Footnote 1007. This office did not investigate Cohen's campaign period payments to women. Footnote 1008. However, those events, as described here, are potentially relevant to the president's and his personal counsel's interactions with Cohen as a witness, who later began to cooperate with the government. On February 13, 2018, Cohen released a statement to news organizations that stated, "In a private transaction in 2016, I used my own personal funds to facilitate a payment of $130,000 to the woman. Neither the Trump Organization nor the Trump campaign was a party to the transaction with the woman, and neither reimbursed me for the payment, either directly or indirectly." Footnote 1009. In congressional testimony on February 27, 2019, Cohen testified that he had discussed what to say about the payment with the president and that the president had directed Cohen to say that the president was not knowledgeable of Cohen's actions in making the payment. Footnote 1010. On February 19, 2018, the day after the New York Times wrote a detailed story attributing the payment to Cohen and describing Cohen as the president's fixer, Cohen received a text message from the president's personal counsel that stated, "Client says thanks for what you do." Footnote 1011. On April 9, 2018, FBI agents working with the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York executed search warrants on Cohen's home, hotel room, and office. Footnote 1012. That day, the president spoke to reporters and said that he had just heard that they broke into the office of one of my personal attorneys, a good man. Footnote 1013. The president called the searches a real disgrace and said, "It's an attack on our country in a true sense. It's an attack on what we all stand for." Footnote 1014. Cohen said that after the searches, he was concerned that he was an open book, that he did not want issues arising from the payments to women to come out, and that his false statements to Congress were a big concern. Footnote 1015. A few days after the searches, the president called Cohen. Footnote 1016. According to Cohen, the president said he wanted to check in and asked if Cohen was okay, and the president encouraged Cohen to hang in there and stay strong. Footnote 1017. Cohen also recalled that following the searches, he heard from individuals who were in touch with the president and relayed to Cohen the president's support for him. Footnote 1018. Cohen recalled that redaction, personal privacy, a friend of the president's reached out to say that he was with the boss in Mar-a-Lago, and the president had said, "He loves you, and not to worry." Footnote 1019. Cohen recalled that redaction, personal privacy, for the Trump Organization told him, "The boss loves you." Footnote 1020. And Cohen said that redaction, personal privacy, a friend of the president's told him, "Everyone knows the boss has your back." Footnote 1021. On or about April 17, 2018, Cohen began speaking with an attorney, Robert Costello, who had a close relationship with Rudolph Giuliani, one of the president's personal lawyers. Footnote 1022. Costello told Cohen that he had a back channel of communication to Giuliani, and that Giuliani had said the channel was crucial and must be maintained. Footnote 1023. On April 20, 2018, the New York Times published an article about the president's relationship with and treatment of Cohen. Footnote 1024. The president responded with a series of tweets predicting that Cohen would not flip. "The New York Times and a third-rate reporter are going out of their way to destroy Michael Cohen and his relationship with me in the hope that he will flip. They use non-existent sources and a drunk-slash-drugged-up loser who hates Michael, a fine person with a wonderful family. Michael is a businessman for his own account-slash-lawyer, who I have always liked and respected. Most people will flip if the government lets them out of trouble, even if it means lying or making up stories. Sorry, I don't see Michael doing that, despite the horrible witch hunt and the dishonest media." Footnote 1025. In an email that day to Cohen, Costello wrote that he had spoken with Giuliani. Footnote 1026. Costello told Cohen the conversation was very, very positive. "You are loved. They are in our corner. Sleep well tonight. You have friends in high places." Footnote 1027. Cohen said that following these messages, he believed he had the support of the White House if he continued to toe the party line, and he determined to stay on message and be part of the team. Footnote 1028. At the time, Cohen's understood that his legal fees were still being paid by the Trump Organization, which he said was important to him. Footnote 1029. Cohen believed he needed the power of the president to take care of him, so he needed to defend the president and stay on message. Footnote 1030. Cohen also recalled speaking with the president's personal counsel about pardons after the searches of his home and office had occurred, at a time when the media had reported that pardon discussions were occurring at the White House. Footnote 1031. Cohen told the president's personal counsel he had been a loyal lawyer and servant, and he said that after the searches he was in an uncomfortable position and wanted to know what was in it for him. Footnote 1032. According to Cohen, the president's personal counsel responded that Cohen should stay on message, that the investigation was a witch hunt, and that everything would be fine. Footnote 1033. Cohen understood, based on this conversation and previous conversations about pardons with the president's personal counsel, that as long as he stayed on message, he would be taken care of by the president, either through a pardon or through the investigation being shut down. Footnote 1034. On April 24, 2018, the president responded to a reporter's inquiry whether he would consider a pardon for Cohen with, "Stupid question." Footnote 1035. On June 8, 2018, the president said he hadn't even thought about pardons for Manafort or Cohen and continued, "It's far too early to be thinking about that. They haven't been convicted of anything. There's nothing to pardon." Footnote 1036. And on June 15, 2018, the president expressed sympathy for Cohen, Manafort, and Flynn in a press interview and said, "I feel badly about a lot of them, because I think a lot of it is very unfair." Footnote 1037. 5. The president's conduct after Cohen began cooperating with the government. On July 2, 2018, ABC News reported, based on an exclusive interview with Cohen, that Cohen strongly signaled his willingness to cooperate with Special Counsel Robert Mueller and federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York, even if that puts President Trump in jeopardy. Footnote 1038. That week, the media reported that Cohen had added an attorney to his legal team who previously had worked as a legal advisor to President Bill Clinton. Footnote 1039. Beginning on July 20, 2018, the media reported on the existence of a recording Cohen had made of a conversation he had with candidate Trump about a payment made to a second woman who said she had had an affair with Trump. Footnote 1040. On July 21, 2018, the president responded, "Inconceivable that the government would break into a lawyer's office early in the morning, almost unheard of. Even more inconceivable that a lawyer would tape a client, totally unheard of and perhaps illegal. The good news is that your favorite president did nothing wrong." Footnote 1041. On July 27, 2018, after the media reported that Cohen was willing to inform investigators that Donald Trump Jr. told his father about the June 9, 2016 meeting to get dirt on Hillary Clinton, footnote 1042, the president tweeted, "So the fake news doesn't waste my time with dumb questions. No, I did not know of the meeting with my son, Don Jr. Sounds to me like someone is trying to make up stories in order to get himself out of an unrelated jam. Taxicabs, maybe?" He even retained Bill and Crooked Hillary's lawyer. Gee, I wonder if they helped him make the choice. Footnote 1043. On August 21, 2018, Cohen pleaded guilty in the Southern District of New York to 8 felony charges, including 2 counts of campaign finance violations based on the payments he had made during the final weeks of the campaign to women who said they had affairs with the president. Footnote 1044. During the plea hearing, Cohen stated that he had worked at the direction of the candidate in making those payments. Footnote 1045. The next day, the president contrasted Cohen's cooperation with Manafort's refusal to cooperate, tweeting, "I feel very badly for Paul Manafort and his wonderful family. Justice took a 12-year-old tax case, among other things, applied tremendous pressure on him, and, unlike Michael Cohen, he refused to break, make up stories in order to get a deal. Such respect for a brave man." Footnote 1046. On September 17, 2018, this office submitted written questions to the president that included questions about the Trump Tower Moscow project and attached Cohen's written statement to Congress and the letter of intent signed by the president. Footnote 1047. Among other issues, the questions asked the president to describe the timing and substance of discussions he had with Cohen about the project, whether they discussed a potential trip to Russia, and whether the president at any time directed or suggested that discussions about the Trump-Moscow project should cease, or whether the president was informed at any time that the project had been abandoned. Footnote 1048. On November 20, 2018, the president submitted written responses that did not answer those questions about Trump Tower Moscow directly and did not provide any information about the timing of the candidate's discussions with Cohen about the project or whether he participated in any discussions about the project being abandoned or no longer pursued. Footnote 1049. Instead, the president's answers stated in relevant part, "I had few conversations with Mr. Cohen on this subject. As I recall, they were brief and they were not memorable. I was not enthused about the proposal, and I do not recall any discussion of travel to Russia in connection with it. I do not remember discussing it with anyone else at the Trump Organization, although it is possible. I do not recall being aware at the time of any communications between Mr. Cohen and Felix Sater and any Russian government official regarding the letter of intent." Footnote 1050. On November 29, 2018, Cohen pleaded guilty to making false statements to Congress based on his statements about the Trump Tower Moscow project. Footnote 1051. In a plea agreement with this office, Cohen agreed to provide truthful information regarding any and all matters as to which this office deems relevant. Footnote 1052. Later, on November 29th, after Cohen's guilty plea had become public, the president spoke to reporters about the Trump Tower Moscow project, saying, "I decided not to do the project. I decided ultimately not to do it. There would have been nothing wrong if I did do it. If I did do it, there would have been nothing wrong. That was my business. It was an option that I decided not to do. I decided not to do it. The primary reason, I was focused on running for president. I was running my business while I was campaigning. There was a good chance that I wouldn't have won, in which case I would have gone back into the business. And why should I lose lots of opportunities?" Footnote 1053. The president also said that Cohen was a weak person, and by being weak, unlike other people that you watch, he is a weak person. And what he's trying to do is get a reduced sentence. So he's lying about a project that everyone knew about. Footnote 1054. The president also brought up Cohen's written submission to Congress regarding the Trump Tower Moscow project. So here's the story. Go back and look at the paper that Michael Cohen wrote before he testified in the House and/or Senate. It talked about his position. footnote 1055. The president added, "Even if Cohen was right, it doesn't matter because I was allowed to do whatever I wanted during the campaign." Footnote 1056. In light of the president's public statements following Cohen's guilty plea that he decided not to do the project, this office again sought information from the president about whether he participated in any discussions about the project being abandoned or no longer pursued, including when he decided not to do the project, who he spoke to about that decision, and what motivated the decision. Footnote 1057. The office also again asked for the timing of the president's discussions with Cohen about Trump Tower Moscow and asked him to specify what period of the campaign he was involved in discussions concerning the project. Footnote 1058. In response, the president's personal counsel declined to provide additional information from the president and stated that the president has fully answered the questions at issue. Footnote 1059. In the weeks following Cohen's plea and agreement to provide assistance to this office, the president repeatedly implied that Cohen's family members were guilty of crimes. On December 3, 2018, after Cohen had filed his sentencing memorandum, the president tweeted, "Michael Cohen asks judge for no prison time. You mean he can do all of the terrible, unrelated to Trump, things having to do with fraud, big loans, taxis, etc., and not serve a long prison term? He makes up stories to get a great and already reduced deal for himself, and gets his wife and father-in-law, who has the money, off scot-free. He lied for this outcome and should, in my opinion, serve a full and complete sentence." Footnote 1060. Redacted. Harm to ongoing matter. Including footnote 1061. On December 12, 2018, Cohen was sentenced to 3 years of imprisonment. Footnote 1062. The next day, the president sent a series of tweets that said, "I never directed Michael Cohen to break the law. Those charges were just agreed to by him in order to embarrass the president and get a much-reduced prison sentence, which he did, including the fact that his family was temporarily let off the hook. As a lawyer, Michael has great liability to me." Footnote 1063. On December 16, 2018, the president tweeted, "Remember, Michael Cohen only became a rat after the FBI did something which was absolutely unthinkable and unheard of until the witch hunt was illegally started. They broke into an attorney's office. Why didn't they break into the DNC to get the server or Crooked's office?" Footnote 1064. In January 2019, after the media reported that Cohen would provide public testimony in a congressional hearing, the president made additional public comments suggesting that Cohen's family members had committed crimes. In an interview on Fox on January 12, 2019, the president was asked whether he was worried about Cohen's testimony and responded, "In order to get his sentence reduced, Cohen says, 'I have an idea. I'll give you some information on the president.' Well, there is no information. But he should give information maybe on his father-in-law because that's the one that people want to look at because where does that money? That's the money in the family. And I guess he didn't want to talk about his father-in-law. He's trying to get his sentence reduced. So it's, pretty sad. You know, it's weak, and it's very sad to watch a thing like that." Footnote 1065. On January 18, 2019, the president tweeted, "Kevin Cork at Fox News, 'Don't forget, Michael Cohen has already been convicted of perjury and fraud, and as recently as this week, the Wall Street Journal has suggested that he may have stolen tens of thousands of dollars. Lying to reduce his jail time. Watch father-in-law.' footnote 1066. On January 23, 2019, Cohen postponed his congressional testimony, citing threats against his family. Footnote 1067. The next day, the president tweeted, "So interesting that bad lawyer Michael Cohen, who sadly will not be testifying before Congress, is using the lawyer of crooked Hillary Clinton to represent him. Gee, how did that happen?" Footnote 1068. Also in January 2019, Giuliani gave press interviews that appeared to confirm Cohen's account that the Trump Organization pursued the Trump Tower Moscow project well past January 2016. Giuliani stated that, "It's our understanding that discussions about the Trump Moscow project went on throughout 2016. Weren't a lot of them, but there were conversations. Can't be sure of the exact date, but the president can remember having conversations with him about it." The president also remembers, yeah, probably up, could be up to as far as October, November. Footnote 1069. In an interview with the New York Times, Giuliani quoted the president as saying that the discussions regarding the Trump Moscow project were going on from the day I announced to the day I won. Footnote 1070. On January 21, 2019, Giuliani issued a statement that said, "My recent statements about discussions during the 2016 campaign between Michael Cohen and candidate Donald Trump about a potential Trump Moscow project were hypothetical and not based on conversations I had with the president." Footnote 1071. Analysis. In analyzing the president's conduct related to Cohen, the following evidence is relevant to the elements of obstruction of justice. A. Obstructive act. We gathered evidence of the president's conduct related to Cohen on two issues. 1. Whether the president or others aided or participated in Cohen's false statements to Congress, and 2. Whether the president took actions that would have the natural tendency to prevent Cohen from providing truthful information to the government. 1. First, with regard to Cohen's false statements to Congress, while there is evidence, described below, that the president knew Cohen provided false testimony to Congress about the Trump Tower Moscow project, the evidence available to us does not establish that the president directed or aided Cohen's false testimony. Cohen said that his statements to Congress followed a party line that developed within the campaign to align with the president's public statements distancing the president from Russia. Cohen also recalled that, in speaking with the president in advance of testifying, he made it clear that he would stay on message, which Cohen believed they both understood would require false testimony. But Cohen said that he and the president did not explicitly discuss whether Cohen's testimony about the Trump Tower Moscow project would be or was false, and the president did not direct him to provide false testimony. Cohen also said he did not tell the president about the specifics of his planned testimony. During the time when his statement to Congress was being drafted and circulated to members of the JDA, Cohen did not speak directly to the president about the statement, but rather communicated with the president's personal counsel, as corroborated by phone records showing extensive communications between Cohen and the president's personal counsel before Cohen submitted his statement and when he testified before Congress. Cohen recalled that in his discussions with the president's personal counsel on August 27, 2017, the day before Cohen's statement was submitted to Congress, Cohen said that there were more communications with Russia and more communications with candidate Trump than the statement reflected. Cohen recalled expressing some concern at that time. According to Cohen, the president's personal counsel, who did not have firsthand knowledge of the project, responded by saying that there was no need to muddy the water, that it was unnecessary to include those details because the project did not take place, and that Cohen should keep his statement short and tight, not elaborate, stay on message, and not contradict the president. Cohen's recollection of the content of those conversations is consistent with direction about the substance of Cohen's draft statement that appeared to come from members of the JDA. For example, Cohen omitted any reference to his outreach to Russian government officials to set up a meeting between Trump and Putin during the United Nations General Assembly. And Cohen believed it was a decision of the JDA to delete the sentence. The building project led me to make limited contacts with Russian government officials. The president's personal counsel declined to provide us with his account of his conversations with Cohen, and there is no evidence available to us that indicates that the president was aware of the information Cohen provided to the president's personal counsel. The president's conversations with his personal counsel were presumptively protected by attorney-client privilege, and we did not seek to obtain the contents of any such communications. The absence of evidence about the president and his counsel's conversations about the drafting of Cohen's statement precludes us from assessing what, if any, role the president played. 2. Second, we considered whether the president took actions that would have the natural tendency to prevent Cohen from providing truthful information to criminal investigators or to Congress. Before Cohen began to cooperate with the government, the president publicly and privately urged Cohen to stay on message and not flip. Cohen recalled the president's personal counsel telling him that he would be protected so long as he did not go rogue. In the days and weeks that followed the April 2018 searches of Cohen's home and office, the president told reporters that Cohen was a good man and said he was a fine person with a wonderful family, who I have always liked and respected. Privately, the president told Cohen to hang in there and stay strong. People who were close to both Cohen and the president passed messages to Cohen that the president loves you, the boss loves you, and everyone knows the boss has your back. Through the president's personal counsel, the president also had previously told Cohen, "Thanks for what you do," after Cohen provided information to the media about payments to women that, according to Cohen, both Cohen and the president knew was false. At that time, the Trump Organization continued to pay Cohen's legal fees, which was important to Cohen. Cohen also recalled discussing the possibility of a pardon with the president's personal counsel, who told him to stay on message and everything would be fine. The president indicated in his public statements that a pardon had not been ruled out, and also stated publicly that most people will flip if the government lets them out of trouble, but that he didn't see Michael doing that. After it was reported that Cohen intended to cooperate with the government, however, the president accused Cohen of making up stories in order to get himself out of an unrelated jam, taxicabs maybe, and called Cohen a rat, and on multiple occasions publicly suggested that Cohen's family members had committed crimes. The evidence concerning this sequence of events could support an inference that the president used inducements in the form of positive messages in an effort to get Cohen not to cooperate, and then turned to attacks and intimidation to deter the provision of information or undermine Cohen's credibility once Cohen began cooperating. B. Nexus to an official proceeding. The president's relevant conduct toward Cohen occurred when the president knew the special counsel's office, Congress, and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York were investigating Cohen's conduct. The president acknowledged through his public statements and tweets that Cohen potentially could cooperate with the government investigations. C. Intent. In analyzing the president's intent in his actions toward Cohen as a potential witness, there is evidence that could support the inference that the president intended to discourage Cohen from cooperating with the government because Cohen's information would shed adverse light on the president's campaign period conduct and statements. 1. Cohen's false congressional testimony about the Trump Tower Moscow project was designed to minimize connections between the president and Russia and to help limit the congressional and DOJ Russia investigations, a goal that was in the president's interest, as reflected by the president's own statements. During and after the campaign, the president made repeated statements that he had no business in Russia and said that there were no deals that could happen in Russia because we've stayed away. As Cohen knew, and as he recalled communicating to the president during the campaign, Cohen's pursuit of the Trump Tower Moscow project cast doubt on the accuracy or completeness of these statements. In connection with his guilty plea, Cohen admitted that he had multiple conversations with candidate Trump to give him status updates about the Trump Tower Moscow project, that the conversations continued through at least June 2016, and that he discussed with Trump possible travel to Russia to pursue the project. The conversations were not offhand, according to Cohen, because the project had the potential to be so lucrative. In addition, text messages to and from Cohen and other records further establish that Cohen's efforts to advance the project did not end in January 2016, and that in May and June 2016, Cohen was considering the timing for possible trips to Russia by him and Trump in connection with the project. The evidence could support an inference that the president was aware of these facts at the time of Cohen's false statements to Congress. Cohen discussed the project with the president in early 2017 following media inquiries. Cohen recalled that on September 20, 2017, the day after he released to the public his opening remarks to Congress, which said the project was terminated in January of 2016, the president's personal counsel told him the president was pleased with what Cohen had said about Trump Tower Moscow. And after Cohen's guilty plea, the president told reporters that he had ultimately decided not to do the project, which supports the inference that he remained aware of his own involvement in the project and the period during the campaign in which the project was being pursued. 2. The president's public remarks following Cohen's guilty plea also suggest that the president may have been concerned about what Cohen told investigators about the Trump Tower Moscow project. At the time, the president submitted written answers to questions from this office about the project and other subjects. The media had reported that Cohen was cooperating with the government, but Cohen had not yet pleaded guilty to making false statements to Congress. Accordingly, it was not publicly known what information about the project Cohen had provided to the government. In his written answers, the president did not provide details about the timing and substance of his discussions with Cohen about the project, and gave no indication that he had decided to no longer pursue the project. Yet after Cohen pleaded guilty, the president publicly stated that he had personally made the decision to abandon the project. The president then declined to clarify the seeming discrepancy to our office or answer additional questions. The content and timing of the president's provision of information about his knowledge and actions regarding the Trump Tower Moscow project is evidence that the president may have been concerned about the information that Cohen could provide as a witness. 3. The president's concern about Cohen cooperating may have been directed at the Southern District of New York investigation into other aspects of the president's dealings with Cohen, rather than an investigation of Trump Tower Moscow. There also is some evidence that the president's concern about Cohen cooperating was based on the president's stated belief that Cohen would provide false testimony against the president in an attempt to obtain a lesser sentence for his unrelated criminal conduct. The president tweeted that Manafort, unlike Cohen, refused to break and make up stories in order to get a deal. And after Cohen pleaded guilty to making false statements to Congress, the president said, "What Cohen's trying to do is get a reduced sentence, so he's lying about a project that everybody knew about." But the president also appeared to defend the underlying conduct, saying, Even if Cohen was right, it doesn't matter because I was allowed to do whatever I wanted during the campaign. As described above, there is evidence that the president knew that Cohen had made false statements about the Trump Tower Moscow project, and that Cohen did so to protect the president and minimize the president's connections to Russia during the campaign. 4. Finally, the president's statements insinuating that members of Cohen's family committed crimes after Cohen began cooperating with the government could be viewed as an effort to retaliate against Cohen and chill further testimony adverse to the president by Cohen or others. It is possible that the president believes, as reflected in his tweets, that Cohen made up stories in order to get a deal for himself and get his wife and father-in-law off scot-free. It also is possible that the president's mention of Cohen's wife and father-in-law were not intended to affect Cohen as a witness, but rather were part of a public relations strategy aimed at discrediting Cohen and deflecting attention away from the president on Cohen-related matters. But the president's suggestion that Cohen's family members committed crimes happened more than once, including just before Cohen was sentenced, at the same time as the president stated that Cohen should, in my opinion, serve a full and complete sentence, and again just before Cohen was scheduled to testify before Congress. The timing of the statements supports an inference that they were intended at least in part to discourage Cohen from further cooperation. L. Overarching factual issues. Although this report does not contain a traditional prosecution decision or declination decision, the evidence supports several general conclusions relevant to analysis of the facts concerning the president's course of conduct. 1. Three features of this case render it atypical compared to the heartland obstruction of justice prosecutions brought by the Department of Justice. First, the conduct involved actions by the president. Some of the conduct did not implicate the president's constitutional authority and raises garden-variety obstruction of justice issues. Other events we investigated, however, drew upon the president's Article II authority, which raised constitutional issues that we address in Volume 2, Section 3, Point B, Infra. A factual analysis of that conduct would have to take into account both that the president's acts were facially lawful and that his position as head of the executive branch provides him with unique and powerful means of influencing official proceedings, subordinate officers, and potential witnesses. Second, many obstruction cases involve the attempted or actual cover-up of an underlying crime. Personal criminal conduct can furnish strong evidence that the individual had an improper obstructive purpose. See, e.g., United States v. Willoughby, 860F.2D1524, Second Circuit, 1988, or that he contemplated an effect on an official proceeding. See, e.g., United States v. Binday, 804F.3D558. 591, Second Circuit, 2015. But proof of such a crime is not an element of an obstruction offense. See United States v. Greer, 872F.3D790798, Sixth Circuit, 2017. Stating, in applying the obstruction sentencing guideline, that obstruction of a criminal investigation is punishable even if the prosecution is ultimately unsuccessful or even if the investigation ultimately reveals no underlying crime. Obstruction of justice can be motivated by a desire to protect non-criminal personal interests, to protect against investigations where underlying criminal liability falls into a gray area, or to avoid personal embarrassment. The injury to the integrity of the justice system is the same, regardless of whether a person committed an underlying wrong. In this investigation, the evidence does not establish that the president was involved in an underlying crime related to Russian election interference. But the evidence does point to a range of other possible personal motives animating the president's conduct. These include concerns that continued investigation would call into question the legitimacy of his election and potential uncertainty about whether certain events, such as advance notice of WikiLeaks' release of hacked information or the June 9, 2016 meeting between senior campaign officials and Russians, could be seen as criminal activity by the president, his campaign, or his family. Third, many of the president's acts directed at witnesses, including discouragement of cooperation with the government and suggestions of possible future pardons, occurred in public view. While it may be more difficult to establish that public-facing acts were motivated by a corrupt intent, the president's power to influence actions, persons, and events is enhanced by his unique ability to attract attention through use of mass communications. And no principle of law excludes public acts from the scope of obstruction statutes. If the likely effect of the acts is to intimidate witnesses or alter their testimony, the justice system's integrity is equally threatened. 2. Although the events we investigated involved discrete acts, e.g., the president's statement to Comey about the Flynn investigation, his termination of Comey, and his efforts to remove the special counsel, it is important to view the president's pattern of conduct as a whole. That pattern sheds light on the nature of the president's acts and the inferences that can be drawn about his intent. A. Our investigation found multiple acts by the president that were capable of exerting undue influence over law enforcement investigations, including the Russian interference and obstruction investigations. The incidents were often carried out through one-on-one meetings in which the president sought to use his official power outside of usual channels. These actions ranged from efforts to remove the special counsel and to reverse the effect of the Attorney General's recusal, to the attempted use of official power to limit the scope of the investigation, to direct and indirect contacts with witnesses with the potential to influence their testimony. Viewing the acts collectively can help to illuminate their significance. For example, the president's direction to McGahn to have special counsel removed was followed almost immediately by his direction to Lewandowski to tell the Attorney General to limit the scope of the Russia investigation to prospective election interference only, a temporal connection that suggests that both acts were taken with a related purpose with respect to the investigation. The president's efforts to influence the investigation were mostly unsuccessful, but that is largely because the persons who surrounded the president declined to carry out orders or accede to his requests. Comey did not end the investigation of Flynn, which ultimately resulted in Flynn's prosecution and conviction for lying to the FBI. McGahn did not tell the acting attorney general that the special counsel must be removed, but was instead prepared to resign over the president's order. Lewandowski and Dearborn did not deliver the president's message to Sessions that he should confine the Russia investigation to future election meddling only. And McGahn refused to recede from his recollections about events surrounding the president's direction to have the special counsel removed, despite the president's multiple demands that he do so. Consistent with that pattern, the evidence we obtained would not support potential obstruction charges against the president's aides and associates beyond those already filed. B. In considering the full scope of the conduct we investigated, the president's actions can be divided into two distinct phases reflecting a possible shift in the president's motives. In the first phase, before the president fired Comey, the president had been assured that the FBI had not opened an investigation of him personally. The president deemed it critically important to make public that he was not under investigation, and he included that information in his termination letter to Comey after other efforts to have that information disclosed were unsuccessful. Soon after he fired Comey, however, the president became aware that investigators were conducting an obstruction of justice inquiry into his own conduct. That awareness marked a significant change in the president's conduct and the start of a second phase of action. The president launched public attacks on the investigation and individuals involved in it who could possess evidence adverse to the president, while in private, the president engaged in a series of targeted efforts to control the investigation. For instance, the president attempted to remove the special counsel. He sought to have Attorney General Sessions unrecuse himself and limit the investigation. He sought to prevent public disclosure of information about the June 9, 2016 meeting between Russians and campaign officials, and he used public forums to attack potential witnesses who might offer adverse information and to praise witnesses who declined to cooperate with the government. Judgments about the nature of the president's motives during each phase would be informed by the totality of the evidence.
3. Legal defenses to the application of obstruction of justice statutes to the president. The president's personal counsel has written to this office to advance statutory and constitutional defenses to the potential application of the obstruction of justice statutes to the president's conduct. Footnote 1072. As a statutory matter, the president's counsel has argued that a core obstruction of justice statute, 18 U.S.C., Section 1512, C.2, does not cover the president's actions. Footnote 1073. As a constitutional matter, the president's counsel argued that the president cannot obstruct justice by exercising his constitutional authority to close Department of Justice investigations or terminate the FBI director. Footnote 1074. Under that view, any statute that restricts the president's exercise of those powers would impermissibly intrude on the president's constitutional role. The president's counsel has conceded that the president may be subject to criminal laws that do not directly involve exercises of his Article II authority, such as laws prohibiting bribing witnesses or suborning perjury. Footnote 1075. But counsel has made a categorical argument that the president's exercise of his constitutional authority here to terminate an FBI director and to close investigations cannot constitutionally constitute obstruction of justice. Footnote 1076. In analyzing counsel's statutory arguments, we concluded that the president's proposed interpretation of Section 1512, C.2, is contrary to the litigating position of the Department of Justice and is not supported by principles of statutory construction. As for the constitutional arguments, we recognize that the Department of Justice and the courts have not definitively resolved these constitutional issues. We therefore analyze the president's position through the framework of Supreme Court precedent addressing the separation of powers. Under that framework, we concluded Article 2 of the Constitution does not categorically and permanently immunize the president from potential liability for the conduct that we investigated. Rather, our analysis led us to conclude that the obstruction of justice statutes can validly prohibit a president's corrupt efforts to use his official powers to curtail, end, or interfere with an investigation. A. Statutory defenses to the application of obstruction of justice provisions to the conduct under investigation. The obstruction of justice statute most readily applicable to our investigation is 18 U.S.C., Section 1512, C.2. Section 1512, C provides C. Whoever corruptly 1. Alters, destroys, mutilates or conceals a record, document, or other object, or attempts to do so, with the intent to impair the object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding, or 2. Otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding, or attempts to do so, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years, or both. The Department of Justice has taken the position that Section 1512(c)(2) states a broad, independent, and unqualified prohibition on obstruction of justice. Footnote 1077. While defendants have argued that subsection C2 should be read to cover only acts that would impair the availability or integrity of evidence, because that is subsection C1's focus, strong arguments weigh against that proposed limitation. The text of section 1512(c)(2) confirms that its sweep is not tethered to section 1512(c)(1). Courts have so interpreted it. Its history does not counsel otherwise, and no principle of statutory construction dictates a contrary view. On its face, therefore, Section 1512(c)(2) applies to all corrupt means of obstructing a proceeding, pending or contemplated, including by improper exercises of official power. In addition, other statutory provisions that are potentially applicable to certain conduct we investigated broadly prohibit obstruction of proceedings that are pending before courts, grand juries, and Congress. See 18 U.S.C. Sections 1503, 1505. Congress has also specifically prohibited witness tampering. See 18 U.S.C. Section 1512b. 1. The text of Section 1512(c)(2) prohibits a broad range of obstructive acts. Several textual features of Section 1512(c)(2) support the conclusion that the provision broadly prohibits corrupt means of obstructing justice and is not limited by the more specific prohibitions in Section 1512(c)(1), which focus on evidence impairment. First, the text of Section 1512(c)(2) is unqualified. It reaches acts that obstruct, influence, or impede any official proceeding when committed corruptly. Nothing in Section 1512(c)(2)'s text limits the provision to acts that would impair the integrity or availability of evidence for use in an official proceeding. In contrast, Section 1512(c)(1) explicitly includes the requirement that the defendant act with the intent to impair the object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding, a requirement that Congress also included in two other sections of Section 1512. See 18 U.S.C. Sections 1512a, 2, b, small Roman numeral 2, use of physical force with intent to cause a person to destroy an object with intent to impair the integrity or availability of the object for use in an official proceeding. 1512b(2)(b). Use of intimidation, threats, corrupt persuasion, or misleading conduct with intent to cause a person to destroy an object with intent to impair the integrity or availability of the object for use in an official proceeding. But no comparable intent or conduct element focused on evidence impairment appears in Section 1512(c)(2). The intent element in Section 1512(c)(2) comes from the word corruptly. See, e.g., United States v. McKibbins, 656 F3D, 707-711, 7th Circuit, 2011. The intent element is important because the word corruptly is what serves to separate criminal and innocent acts of obstruction. Internal quotation marks omitted. And the conduct element in Section 1512(c)(2) is obstructing, influencing, or impeding a proceeding. Congress is presumed to have acted intentionally in the disparate inclusion and exclusion of evidence impairment language. See Loughran v. United States, 573 U.S. 351, 358, 2014. When Congress includes particular language in one section of a statute, but omits it in another, let alone in the very next provision, this court presumes that Congress intended a difference in meaning, quoting Rosello v. United States, 464 U.S. 16, 23, 1983. Accord Digital Realty Trust, Inc. v. Somers, 138 S. C.T. 767-777, 2018. Second, the structure of Section 1512 supports the conclusion that Section 1512(c)(2) defines an independent offense. Section 1512(c)(2) delineates a complete crime with different elements from Section 1512(c)(1), and each subsection of Section 1512(c) contains its own attempt prohibition, underscoring that they are independent prohibitions. The two subsections of Section 1512(c) are connected by the conjunction or, indicating that each provides an alternative basis for criminal liability. See Loughran, 573 U.S., at 357. Ordinary use of or is almost always disjunctive, that is, the words it connects are to be given separate meanings, internal quotation marks omitted. In Loughran, for example, the Supreme Court relied on the use of the word or to hold that adjacent and overlapping subsections of the bank fraud statute, 18 U.S.C., section 1344, state distinct offenses, and that subsection 1344(2) therefore should not be interpreted to contain an additional element specified only in subsection 1344(1). Id. See also Shaw v. United States, 137 S.C.T. 462, 465-469, 2016, recognizing that the subsections of the bank fraud statute overlap substantially, but identifying distinct circumstances covered by each, footnote 1078. And here, as in Loughran, Section 1512(c)'s two clauses have separate numbers, line breaks before, between, and after them, and equivalent indentation, thus placing the clauses visually on an equal footing and indicating that they have separate meanings. 573 U.S. at 359. Third, the introductory word otherwise in Section 1512(c)(2) signals that the provision covers obstructive acts that are different from those listed in Section 1512(c)(1). See Black's Law Dictionary, 1101, 6th edition, 1990. Otherwise means in a different manner, in another way, or in other ways. See also, e.g., American Heritage College Dictionary Online. 1. In another way. Differently. 2. Under other circumstances. See also Gooch v. United States, 297 U.S. 124, 128, 1936, characterizing otherwise as a broad term and holding that a statutory prohibition on kidnapping for ransom or reward or otherwise is not limited by the words ransom and reward to kidnappings for pecuniary benefits. Colossos v. United States, 368 F3D 190 200, 2D, Circuit 2004, construing otherwise in 28 U.S.C., Section 2466 1C, to reach beyond the specific examples listed in prior subsections, thereby covering the myriad means that human ingenuity might devise to permit a person to avoid the jurisdiction of a court. C.F. Begay v. United States, 553 U.S. 137, 144, 2006, recognizing that otherwise is defined to mean in a different way or manner, and holding that the word otherwise, introducing the residual clause in the Armed Career Criminal Act, 18 U.S.C., Section 924(e)(2)(b), little Roman numeral 2, can, but need not necessarily, refer to a crime that is similar to the listed examples in some respects, but different in others. Footnote 1079. The purpose of the word otherwise in Section 1512(c)(2) is therefore to clarify that the provision covers obstructive acts other than the destruction of physical evidence with the intent to impair its integrity or availability, which is the conduct addressed in Section 1512(c)(1). The word otherwise does not signal that Section 1512(c)(2) has less breadth in covering obstructive conduct than the language of the provision implies. 2. Judicial decisions support a broad reading of Section 1512(c)(2). Courts have not limited Section 1512(c)(2) to conduct that impairs evidence, but instead have read it to cover obstructive acts in any form. As one court explained, this expansive subsection operates as a catch-all to cover otherwise obstructive behavior that might not constitute a more specific offense, like document destruction, which is listed in C1. United States v. Volpin Desto, 746 F 3D 273 286, 7th Circuit, 2014. Some quotation marks omitted. For example, in United States v. Ring, 628F.Sup.2D195DDC 2009, the court rejected the argument that Section 1512(c)(2)'s reference to conduct that otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding is limited to conduct that is similar to the type of conduct prescribed by subsection C1, namely, conduct that impairs the integrity or availability of records, documents, or other objects for use in an official proceeding. Id. At 224. The court explained that the meaning of Section 1512(c)(2) is plain on its face. Id. Alterations in original. And courts have upheld convictions under Section 1512(c)(2) that did not involve evidence impairment, but instead resulted from conduct that more broadly thwarted arrests or investigations. C.E.G. United States v. Martinez, 862F3D 223-238, 2nd Circuit, 2017, police officer tipped off suspects about issuance of arrest warrants before outstanding warrants could be executed, thereby potentially interfering with an ongoing grand jury proceeding. United States v. Ahrensfield, 698F3D 1310, 1324-1326, 10th Circuit, 2012. Officer disclosed existence of an undercover investigation to its target. United States v. Phillips, 583F3D 1261-1265, 10th Circuit, 2009. Defendant disclosed identity of an undercover officer, thus preventing him from making controlled purchases from methamphetamine dealers. Those cases illustrate that Section 1512(c)(2) applies to corrupt acts, including by public officials, that frustrate the commencement or conduct of a proceeding, and not just to acts that make evidence unavailable or impair its integrity. Section 1512(c)(2)'s breadth is reinforced by the similarity of its language to the Omnibus Clause of 18 U.S.C. Section 1503, which covers anyone who corruptly obstructs or impedes or endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede the due administration of justice. That clause of Section 1503 follows two more specific clauses that protect jurors, judges, and court officers. The Omnibus Clause has nevertheless been construed to be far more general in scope than the earlier clauses of the statute. United States v. Aguilar, 515 U.S. 593-599-1995. The Omnibus Clause is essentially a catch-all provision, which generally prohibits conduct that interferes with the due administration of justice. United States v. Brenson, 104F3D-1267-1275, 11th Circuit, 1997. Courts have accordingly given it a non-restrictive reading. United States v. Cumar, 617F3D-612-620, 2nd Circuit, 2010. Id. At 620N7, collecting cases from the 3rd, 4th, 6th, 7th, and 11th Circuits. As one court has explained, The omnibus clause prohibits acts that are similar in result, rather than manner, to the conduct described in the first part of the statute. United States v. Howard, 569 F2D, 1331, 1333, Fifth Circuit, 1978. While the specific clauses forbid certain means of obstructing justice, the omnibus clause aims at obstruction of justice itself, regardless of the means used to reach that result, id. Collecting cases. Given the similarity of Section 1512(c)(2) to Section 1503's Omnibus Clause, Congress would have expected Section 1512(c)(2) to cover acts that produced a similar result to the evidence impairment provisions, i.e., the result of obstructing justice, rather than covering only acts that were similar in manner. Read this way, Section 1512(c)(2) serves a distinct function in the federal obstruction of justice statutes. It captures corrupt conduct, other than document destruction, that has the natural tendency to obstruct contemplated as well as pending proceedings. Section 1512(c)(2) overlaps with other obstruction statutes, but it does not render them superfluous. Section 1503, for example, which covers pending grand jury and judicial proceedings, and Section 1505, which covers pending administrative and congressional proceedings, reach endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede the proceedings. A broader test for inchoate violations than Section 1512(c)(2)'s attempt standard, which requires a substantial step towards a completed offense. See United States v. Sampson, 898 F3D 287, 302, Second Circuit, 2018. Efforts to witness tamper that rise to the level of an endeavor yet fall short of an attempt cannot be prosecuted under Section 1512. United States v. Leisure, 844 F2D 1347, 1366-1367, 8th Circuit, 1988. Collecting cases recognizing the difference between the endeavor and attempt standards. And 18 U.S.C. Section 1519, which prohibits destruction of documents